Okay, if you got a Bible with you, go ahead and open it to Leviticus 18. Tonight is going to be our last regular installment of Clarity Over Chaos teaching unit that Pastor Jim and I have shared over the last several months. Our goal in all of this, in Clarity Over Chaos, in having a policy to address these matters at church, our goal has always been to articulate, to define, and to apply in an ongoing way a biblical theology of sexual ethics and gender. This series of study has gone back several months, off and on. The need for the unit of study was made acute because our society is currently reeling from the chaos set loose on it by an ongoing sexual revolution. For a time, it seemed like the people who survived the 60s had weathered the worst of it. And then my generation grew up and we said, just kidding, here's the 2000s and the 90s and the 20-teens, and it just keeps going on. In our broader culture, practically nothing remains of a biblical sexual ethic, and things have deteriorated to the point that the very idea of gender and a fixed understanding of male and female as an objective reality is seen now as outdated, oppressive, ideological. As things progress, though, and the sexual revolution continues to bring gender chaos into our lives, we're beginning to witness the undeniable negative effects, the carnage of that in life that is brought to our country and to our families. In the middle of that, we hold firm to the understanding that God has not left us as his people to muddle about ignorantly. Right? We don't have to grope about our lives. We don't have to blindly attempt to feel our way through these things because our God has revealed his will to us in his word. And so we have turned again and again to the Bible and have found information and answers for the things that our country is dealing with and for the questions that are plaguing us as a people. Along the way, we have noted at various points how God's good design in creation and the biological realities that he has built into his world. We've noted how mankind has variously tried to alter that design or even sometimes to reject it altogether in favor of something new, a newly invented sexual morality, a newly invented understanding of gender. If you want, you can go back. I think we're up to number 7 in this teaching unit so far. You can go back to listen to each of those sessions in turn online, and you can learn what the Bible has to say about gender, about sexual temptation, about transgender questions, and how these things have brought devastation and hurt to people as they pursue their own feelings, as opposed to submitting ourselves to God's good design, but also in terms of having hope and what the Bible holds out as a potential for human flourishing in these things. Right, tonight, I said, is our last regular installment. We'll have one more irregular, I guess you could say, night to come. It's impossible to address every question. And a lot of the times what gets left out of public teaching on this, by necessity almost, is some of the answers to more practical questions or how-tos or whatabouts or what should I if. Right, so what we're going to do is on September 8th, in the PM service, Pastor Jim and I are going to host a family chat night that's going to be dedicated to a Q&A session on these matters of sexuality and gender, just to wrap up the Clarity Over Chaos teaching. And our church family will set the agenda for that Q&A session. And the best way to be a part of that is to, if you have remaining questions, is to submit them ahead of time and make sure they get answered on that night. During the month of August, we'll have a box on the Welcome Center counter, and you can drop questions into that box that you have regarding anything that's been brought up on human sexuality, gender, Clarity Over Chaos, transgender, temptation, anything. And you don't have to put your name on it. It can be anonymous if you want. In addition to the box in the Welcome Center, if you email your question to Pastor Jim or I, it'll get into the thing. If you don't like us, you can email it to Carolyn, because everyone likes Carolyn. Like I said, you don't have to put your name on it. It can be anonymous if you want. But you can also just show up on September 8th and ask your question from the floor. We'll answer any questions in the box submitted ahead of time, but we'll also have microphones available to take questions on the spot. Okay? That will be then, September 8th. Tonight, we find ourselves in Leviticus 18. If you were in my Sunday school class on Leviticus, some of this material will be familiar to you. We did cover some of it there. For the rest of us, it will perhaps be a new thing to consider from Leviticus 18. It's going to help us to know ahead of time, before we read this chapter, that this is one part of Moses giving the Israelite people the law of God for their brand new nation. When we pick up reading here in chapter 18, they have only recently, as in a matter of days or weeks before this, come out of Egypt, where they were slaves and completely unorganized as a country. God is now making of them a new nation. And Leviticus, along with the second half of Exodus, serves as the law code for their new nation. Keeping that in mind, let's begin reading in verse 1, and we'll see what God has to teach us. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel, and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do what is done in the land of Egypt where you lived, nor are you to do what is done in the land of Canaan where I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. You are to perform my judgments and keep my statutes, to live in accord with them. I am the Lord your God. So you shall keep my statutes and my judgments, by which a man may live. If he does them, I am the Lord. None of you shall approach any blood relative of his to uncover nakedness. I am the Lord. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father, that is, the nakedness of your mother. She is your mother. You are not to uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's wife. It is your father's nakedness. The nakedness of your sister, either your father's daughter or your mother's daughter, whether born at home or born outside, their nakedness you shall not uncover. The nakedness of your son's daughter or your daughter's daughter, their nakedness you shall not uncover, for their nakedness is yours. The nakedness of your father's wife's daughter, born to your father, she is your sister. You shall not uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's sister. She is your father's blood relative. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister, for she is your mother's blood relative. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's brother. You shall not approach his wife. She is your aunt. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your daughter-in-law. She is your son's wife. You shall not uncover her nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your brother's wife. It is your brother's nakedness. You shall not uncover the nakedness of a woman and her daughter, nor shall you take her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter to uncover her nakedness. They are blood relatives. It is lewdness. You shall not marry a woman in addition to her sister as a rival while she is alive to uncover her nakedness. Also, you shall not approach a woman to uncover her nakedness during her menstrual impurity. You shall not have intercourse with your neighbor's wife to be defiled by her. You shall not give any of your offspring to offer them to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. You shall not lie with a male as one lies with a female. It is an abomination. Also, you shall not have intercourse with any animal to be defiled by it, nor shall any woman stand before an animal to mate with it. It is a perversion. Do not defile yourselves by any of these things, for by all these the nations which I am casting out before you have become defiled. For the land has become defiled, therefore I have brought its punishment upon it. So the land has spewed out its inhabitants. But as for you, you are to keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not do any of these abominations, neither the native nor the alien who sojourns among you. For the men of the land who have been before you have done all these abominations, and the land has become defiled, so that the land will not spew you out, should you defile it, as it has spewed out the nation which has been before you. For whoever does any of these abominations, those persons who do so shall be cut off from among their people. Thus you are to keep my charge, that you do not practice any of the abominable customs which have been practiced before you, so as not to defile yourselves with them. I am the Lord your God. This is one of those chapters. You read it, especially if you get to read it out loud in public, and you are simultaneously perhaps embarrassed and puzzled. Why in the world does God feel the need to spell this out? Right? There is a preamble of two or three verses, and then four or five verses at the end to wrap things up. But the body of the chapter itself is almost painfully specific regarding precisely who and or what was in view when God called the Israelites out of Egypt as a nation to a sexual morality that was apparently uncommon in their day. And even though Moses expresses things euphemistically here, there can be no doubt that sexual activity is what is in view and intended to be legislated by God. The repeated phrase here over and over again of uncovered nakedness is a literal rendering of an ancient euphemism that was very much akin to an even older phrase that goes back to Genesis, where it would say to lie with, as in Adam lie with his wife and she bore him a son. Also the equivalent to our modern euphemism of to sleep with. This is all such that what we have here in Leviticus 18 is not laws against indecent exposure or assault or laws governing who can be married to who. Rather, what we have is Levitical laws for the Israelites in their new country created by God governing who it is acceptable to have sexual relations with and who it is not. The content of the chapter is admittedly jarring. You read it and you go, okay then. It starts out innocently enough, though. Look at verse 1. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. You shall not do what is done in the land of Egypt where you lived, nor are you to do what is done in the land of Canaan where I am bringing you. You shall not walk in their statutes. That's a sentiment that gets repeated often in the book of Leviticus, both explicitly and implicitly, where God says, don't be like the pagans. God expected his people to be different, to stand out from the world around them, and to be distinctly his and known as such. Right? One way of doing that is for the Israelites to be set apart based on some of the things they did not do as a people. Whether they be Egyptian pagans or Canaanite pagans, it didn't matter. God said the way they are living in this area of sexual morality and activity is not right. So don't be like them. Instead, he tells them in verse 4, you are to perform my judgments and keep my statutes to live in accord with them. I am the Lord your God. So you shall keep my statutes and my judgments by which a man may live if he does them. I am the Lord. And these verses, 4 and 5, represent a subordination of the will of the people to the will of God. Essentially, God says to the people, listen, I know the ways of living and society that you are used to in Egypt where you came from. And I know the ways of living and society that you are used to in Canaan where you're going. But I don't want you to be like them and live by their ways. I want you to be different, and I want you to live by my ways. And then, over the course of the next 20 verses or so, which we're not going to reread, he goes on to name and list in painful detail exactly what those ways of living in society were that he expected his people to avoid. And every one of them has to do with the pursuit of sexual activity. And it is striking to read and realize that they are all negative commands. They're all prohibitions. They're all thou shalt nots. this chapter is one big example of God repeatedly, almost continually here, telling people what they can't do. In that way, Leviticus 18 represents a massive undercutting of what we, in our 21st century vernacular, might call bodily autonomy. Autonomy means freedom, the right of self-government. Bodily autonomy, freedom of the body, is the concept of life that says, it's my body, and I can do whatever I want with it. Who are you to tell me what I can and can't do? Who I can and can't love, or who I can and can't sleep with? And the implied answer of our enlightened age is no one. Under the idea of bodily autonomy in the 21st century, no one can tell you what to do. No one can tell you who to sleep with or what not to do. You have, the world tells us, bodily autonomy. As we consider the text of Leviticus 18, we come to realize that we in our day are not so different from them in their day. At first blush, when you read this, and you might actually be blushing when you read it, Leviticus 18 is about sexual morality. And it certainly is not about less than that. But it doesn't mean that it isn't about more than that. Because in a biblical worldview, sex is never an end to itself. And sexual expression is never only about itself alone. If you do a little study on Leviticus 18, because I know you're going to run home and do that, you can find all kinds of books, articles, more than you would think, of various explanations that propose all sorts of reasons why God would restrict this particular practice or that particular thing. Some writers go verse by verse through this chapter, command by command, and attempt to explain on pragmatic or practical grounds why God would have prohibited this or that. And the proposed answers are everything from the risk of birth defects, family strife, disease. It goes kind of on and on and on. I know you're going to be disappointed, but we're not going to do that tonight. If I thought it was practical or beneficial, we would. The problem is the whole thing is just an exercise in speculation. At the end of the day, though, Leviticus 18 is less about possible divine motivations for specific restrictions and more about the fact that there are restrictions at all. And by restricting the Israelite sexual activity, God was making a point that it was He, not they, that set the way things would be. It was He, not they, who knew best how to express human sexuality. And it was He, not they, who was going to have the final say in these things. And that conflict of His will versus their will is really what I think lies behind this chapter. It's why it's full of commands and prohibitions and thou shalt nots, as well as the rest of what the Bible teaches in a positive way about sexual morality elsewhere, when you get to places like 1 Corinthians 7. It has a purpose, God says, of sexual activity. But it isn't what you think it is. See, you think your sexuality is about you, but it isn't. That was a common belief in the days of ancient Israel, apparently. It's common enough in our own day now, right, to believe and act as if sexuality is all about me, what I like, who I am. We want to have that full bodily autonomy. You can go culture to culture, and the actual practices might vary from time to time. But this attitude and the aim of God's intention remains consistent. the attitude, so too, of the people remains consistent. I'm in charge. I do what I want, how I want, with who I want, because this is an expression of my sexuality. But now, with us in the 21st century, the same as with the Israelites in Leviticus 18, God chimes in and expresses a different notion. And he's telling the people, he's telling us, I never designed you to be that way, he says. My intentions for the expression of these things is far different from where people have taken them to. You read in Leviticus 18, and you read that it says these things were common in the land of Egypt, in the land of Canaan. We find here a similar atmosphere of libertarian sexual expression, where people seem to have been driven by their own appetites and desires almost without restraint. And that's maybe a little too familiar in our day and age. But with this chapter in Leviticus 18, God is telling his people, it was never supposed to be like that. Things have gone wrong, off the rails. Let's put them right. God says that his created image bearers are supposed to be driven by their devotion to him, a devotion which is higher and deeper than a devotion to one's own body and desires. And so as the people of God, we will sacrifice, like the Israelites, our own bodily autonomy in order to express our devotion to God by subjecting my will to his own. When we do that, for the Israelites as well as for us, sexual fidelity becomes an expression of worship and commitment to God, which is essential to keep in mind, because in that biblical worldview, sex is always a means to an end and not the end itself. Whenever we forget that, we go against God's will, regardless of what we happen to be doing or who we happen to be doing it with. Because for the Israelites then, as it is now for us, pursuing a course in life where we subject our will in these things and our desires in these things to God's will and God's desires is going to mark someone out as different, distinct from the rest of everyone else. The Israelites would be known to be not like the Egyptians, not like the Canaanites. And this would be at least in part because of their practice of sexual morality. I mean, overall, when Moses is done laying this out here, this is a really uncomfortable 30 verses of Scripture. But when you get right into it, there might not be another passage in the Bible that more directly reflects our own time period of social transition than this one, because of the libertarian attitudes that lie behind the commands. And you read this, and the obvious reality in the background, unspoken though it might be here in Leviticus 18, is the fact that intimate relations between a husband and wife were not only acceptable, but assumed. Because God, by painstakingly prohibiting nearly every other conceivable sexual option, God has made it abundantly clear to his people that his will is that sexual activity be expressed only between a husband and his wife. And that expectation hasn't gone away. We don't read Leviticus for law. I understand that. And we repeated it roughly 3 times every week in Sunday school. We're not looking for law. We're looking for reasons as to why God does what he does. And what he's doing here is expressing his will for people in this area of life. And a biblical theology of sexual ethics would affirm and reinforce that God has maintained these expectations throughout each era and each dispensation of time. We live in a 21st century age that fancies itself as progressive, as liberated. We're throwing off those pesky strictures of religion and giving ourselves over to the free expression of sexuality, of becoming like Egypt, of becoming like Canaan. In the middle of all of that, God still holds out a different way, the way of his original intention for mankind. In 1942, C.S. Lewis originally composed his book, Mere Christianity, as a means of explaining Christian doctrine to non-Christians, and he wrote about sexual morality. Back in the 1942 when he wrote it, he called it chastity. And this is what he had to say in 1942. Sexual morality is the most unpopular of the Christian virtues. There's no getting away from it. The Christian rule is either marriage with complete faithfulness to your partner or else total abstinence. Now, this is so difficult and so contrary to our instincts that obviously either Christianity is wrong or our sexual instinct, as it now is, has gone wrong. One or the other. And with that summary, C.S. Lewis nails it on the proverbial head, so to speak. There is undeniably an unavoidable conflict between God's expressed will and mankind's expressed desires. And we have seen that over and over again in each session of Clarity Over Chaos, how God's word teaches one thing about sexuality and gender, while the culture around us and our desires inside of us are telling us a different thing. The question really becomes, who will you listen to? Or maybe even better yet, why listen to God and why should I live by his ways? In Leviticus 18, God gave the Israelites his answer to that. Look at verse 4 again. You are to perform my judgments and keep my statutes, to live in accord with them. I am the Lord your God. So you shall keep my statutes and my judgments, by which a man shall live if he does them. I am the Lord. And then that phrase, I am the Lord, gets repeated later on. And there are two declarative statements in those verses, each one of them aimed at one of the two different groups of people in this passage. You, God says to his people, Israelites, you ought to live this way because I am, he says, the Lord your God. That was God speaking directly to his people, the ones who had voluntarily associated themselves with his name and had committed to a covenant of living by his ways. And he says, this question, then, of sexual activity and expression is actually an issue of expressing your worship to me. I am the Lord your God. And so it is that now with us, as then with them, that God calls his people to be different from the world around us as it pertains to sexual ethics, to be chaste, to submit our desires to his will, to voluntarily restrict our bodily autonomy in the worship and service of a devotion higher and deeper than our devotion to ourselves and our own bodies and desires. A devotion to, a worship of, even, God. You see, Christians and the Bible are not opposed to alternative expressions of sexuality because we are prudes or traditionalists. No. No, we teach that alternative expressions of sexuality are wrong because they are a rebellion against God and they are a refusal to live by his ways. by substituting, when we insist on bodily autonomy, by substituting our will for God's will, we enshrine self on the throne of life where only God should sit. That's why I think those commentators that use up so much ink and paper to try and pin down a practical reason for each and every single prohibition in these chapters are maybe a bit misguided. I mean, it very well may be that you can get a disease or have a deformed baby if you do these prohibited things. I understand that. But disease and birth defects sometimes happen in the best of circumstances, when you've done everything right in your life, so to speak. And that's not the point here. We can make practical appeals all day long about the inevitable decline of population and the natural design of the universe and the spread of disease, or the fill in the blank with whatever is the popular negative consequence of the debate at the moment. But for God's people, at the end of the day, it comes down to worship. We may not often think of it this way, but if we're understanding Leviticus 18 correctly, it teaches us that the expression as well as the non-expression of sexuality is fundamentally about worship. The only question that remains to be answered by God's people each day and every time is worship of who? But of course, the non-people of God, un-Christian citizens of the world, they don't see it like that, because they have no love of God in their heart. They have no desire at all to worship Him. And I think that the world's perception of God's ethics in this regard are fairly well summed up by a story told by C.S. Lewis again. There's a story about a schoolboy who was asked what he thought God was like. He replied that, as far as he could make out, God was the sort of person who's always snooping around to see if anyone is enjoying himself and then trying to stop it. And I am afraid that this is the sort of idea that the word morality raises in a good many people's minds. Something that interferes, something that stops you from having a good time. It seems to be exactly that mindset which God addresses with His second declarative phrase. This one from verse 5, where He says, "I am the Lord." I'm not trying to spoil fun. I'm trying to communicate authority, He says. The first time, speaking to the Israelites in verse 4, He said, "I am the Lord, your God," which was a specific theological statement for the people under His covenant. But in verses 5, and again later in the chapter, He simply says, "I am the Lord." Some of your Bibles just might say, "I am." Yahweh is the word turned name for God. Yahweh, the self-existent creator of all things, has thus expressed His will for all of His created image bearers, not just the ones who are called according to His purpose and who bear His name. Interestingly enough, it is somewhat common now, I don't know if you've noticed this, to use nouns as complete sentence responses to a question. Right? For instance, I may ask a student at school, "How are you today?" And they'll say, "Oh, I have a headache." Sorry to hear that. I might respond, "Why do you have a headache?" But then as a response, sometimes all I'll get back is, "Because math." As if that answers every possible question related to headaches, right? "Why do you have a headache?" "Because math." And as weird as it might sound at first, that's a little bit of what God does here at the end of verse 5. "Because I am the Lord." Why should sexual appetites be tamed? why should sexual expression be kept within these specified limits? Because Yahweh, the Lord Yahweh, the self-existent creator of all that is, the designer and the builder of humanity itself, has decreed that it should be so. This is a declarative statement from God expressing to humanity, His people and not His people alike, how they were designed and created to live as it regards sexual expression and activity. For God's people, it is a question of worship. For not God's people, the issue is a question of design and of function. I feel bad quoting C.S. Lewis like 9 times here, but he is super helpful when he continues that same paragraph from last time, very next sentence. In reality, moral rules are directions for running the human machine. Every moral rule is there to prevent a breakdown or a strain or a friction in the running of that machine. That is why these rules at first seem to be constantly interfering with our natural inclinations. When you are being taught how to use any machine, the instructor keeps on saying, "No, don't do it like that." Because, of course, there are all sorts of things that look all right and seem to you the natural way of treating the machine, but do not really work. When you break things down to the most fundamental level, the question of sexual ethics and activity, what we've been talking about for several sessions now, trying to bring clarity and not chaos, is a question of worship on the one hand and authority on the other hand, depending on whether you are God's people or not. And a question as to how human beings are designed to function, to live, and what ethical stance will best provide for human flourishing. All along in Clarity Over Chaos, we have been seeing how, step by step, the modern day liberated worldview that enshrines bodily autonomy and personal feelings as the highest good and the most reliable authority. And we've seen that it's not working. I understand that the truthfulness of Scripture does not rest on the marshaling of information and statistics, but it should not. It's also not surprising that as the sexual gender revolution continues to unfold and data begins to pour in, that much of it is not good. That the trend in our newly liberated society is a discouraging one. That reports of depression and anxiety are spiking. Sexual satisfaction is actually plummeting, while suicide rates continue to climb. And if you think all the way back to Pastor Jim's very first installment in Clarity Over Chaos, you might remember that he pointed out research that shows suicide rates in the transsexual or transgender community are alarmingly, even exponentially higher than the norm. And then you contrast that with those who choose the supposedly outdated, more restrictive ways of God. I understand the truthfulness of God's word does not rise or fall based on statistics, but we should not be surprised to learn that the Institute for Family Studies has recently published major new research that concludes that highly religious married couples experience greater satisfaction in their intimate lives and greater degrees of health in their intimate relationships. That is not what we see portrayed in the movies or on Netflix. But it is the reality of the picture that is emerging on the ground and the chaos that the sexual revolution is causing as these events unfold. And that clarity that the will of God brings to life stands sharply contrasted with the chaos and the dysfunction of the sexual revolution. In his writings on this subject for National Review, David French points out that sexual liberation too often brings neither sex nor liberation. The Bible holds out a better way, and it undergirds the reasoning for that way in the authority of God as the inventor, the designer, and the creator of what C.S. Lewis called the human machine. Because when you get down to it, all of this that we've gone through, clarity or chaos, bodily autonomy, sexual libertarianism, binary genders, social constructs, all of it is going to be simply variation on a theme and the natural outworkings of the central question of who is sovereign? Who is in charge of humanity? Who has the right? Who has the knowledge to tell humanity how to live? One more point from C.S. Lewis, and we'll leave him alone. Does it not make a great difference whether I am, so to speak, the landlord of my own mind and body, or only a tenant, responsible to the real landlord? If somebody else made me for his own purposes, then I shall have a lot of duties which I should not have if I simply belonged to myself. And that last sentence just encapsulates the entire question that has driven and continues to drive this series of clarity over chaos. To whom do we belong? To whom are we responsible? The Bible answers Leviticus 18 and 1 Corinthians 7 elsewhere. The Bible answers, we belong to God, believers or not. God's people or not. Our world fancies human beings as liberated people with personal bodily autonomy, having been enshrined as the God of this age, and my own feelings as the ultimate trump card. Leviticus 18 undercuts that notion, implying what later scriptures would make quite explicit, that in the biblical scheme of things, These are all means to an end, never an end itself. But the ongoing sexual and gender revolution really has unleashed chaos in our world by removing God from this place as Lord, by disavowing God as creator and designer of humanity and setting up our own ideas as to what is right. The result has been chaos. And we see that time and time again. But in the middle of that chaos stands the truth of God and the testimony of His Word, bringing clarity to life. So yes, we give up bodily autonomy. It's what God asks of us. We give up the illusion of self-liberation. We give up, but we get so much more in return. God promises life, abundant life. God promises true freedom. Whom the Son sets free, he is free indeed. God promises satisfaction. He promises purposefulness of living that no amount of sexual libertarianism could ever hope to match. And he says, this is all possible because I made you, I created you, all of you. You are my image bearers. He is God who knows best how the human machine ought to run. He is creator of you, creator of me, creator of the sexual being that C.S. Lewis called the human machine. He alone, that means, has the right and the authority and the knowledge to say how life ought to be run in regards to these things. we would do well to heed those intentions, to carry out those instructions in our lives as we pursue them. Clarity awaits if we will, but chaos if we will not.